from KQED.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm John Sepulvedo, and today for Mina Kim, sitting right across from me now, retired four-star General Stanley McChrystal, who is in charge of U.S. and allied forces in Afghanistan, is here in the studio to talk about his new book about leaders, Leaders, Myth and Reality. This book profiles 13 famous figures throughout history who took unconventional paths to becoming successful CEOs, politicians, or revolutionaries. McChrystal joins me now to lay out the sometimes surprising traits that make up a great leader. Welcome, General McChrystal. Thank you.
John, thanks for having me.
And you told me to call you Stan. Do you
please.
I've been called worse.
So. Stan's great.
I'm sure you've been called worse by better. General McChrystal, I'm gonna stick with that just to... You began this book, I understand, looking at why Robert E. Lee is so revered. Why did that interest you? And are you a big fan of Robert E. Lee personally?
Well, it's conflicted. I've always been interested in leadership and spent a lifetime trying to be a leader. And then I came to a point in life when I realized I don't think I really understand what leadership is, and I don't think any of us do.
And is this while you were a four-star?
It is, but okay. It has increased in the years since as I've been studying and writing about it. And Robert E. Lee's a great example of that. I grew up with the idea of Robert E. Lee. I grew up near his boyhood home. I went to
Virginia?
I did.
Yeah, okay.
I went to Washington Lee High School.
Okay.
I went to West Point, the same place Robert E. Lee went. And I had always thought of Lee as the perfect leader. He was courteous, brave, decisive, all of these things. He led an army with great tactical success in the Civil War. And at West Point, he was revered. There were paintings. I lived in Lee Barracks. Mm-hmm. And so for 40 years, on the wall, wherever my wife and I lived, I had this painting, a very inexpensive thing she'd given me back when I was a second lieutenant. And I displayed it proudly because he was the example to people who visited my house and myself of what leadership was.
Uh-huh. I was just going to say, I've lived in the South, too, and before lest anyone start calling asking how we can support a Confederate general, he is really in the South. There's this mythology about him being the gentleman general.
That's right.
Yeah. So obviously, something has changed with regard to how you look at him.
Well, I think it became more complete because I had looked at him a bit two-dimensionally, like all the statues mm-hmm. and paintings. Mm-hmm. And then after Charlottesville in the spring of 2017, my wife said, "You need to think about that picture because it may be sending a message to people in our home that you don't believe in, mm-hmm. i.e. white supremacy." And after about a month of ruminating over it, I threw the picture away, threw it in the garbage. And it was an emotional thing. And I also launched on a more detailed study of Robert E. Lee. When I came to the conclusion is he was all the things I thought he was. He was an incredible cadet at West Point, mm-hmm. tremendous officer for 32 years in the Army. But if you really got objective, he lost the war. He didn't win. But even more so, in the spring of 1861, he made a difficult decision to go with Virginia and to forget the oath or to betray the oath that he'd made at West Point, the same oath I made mm-hmm. to the United States, and then to spend 4 years trying to split the United States in half. And he did it ultimately for the maintenance of slavery. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't make Robert E. Lee evil. It doesn't mean that I suddenly don't admire anything about him. It means that I view him as a real human, a flawed human, not a statue or a painting anymore, but just like you and I, John, mm-hmm. people that make mistakes. And I think that we've got to recognize that about all our leaders.
I think one of the things about the Confederacy and many of these statues of the Confederates went up, who people don't have the same perhaps army history that you do, but many Confederate statues went up during a time when white Southerners were reasserting their white supremacy. What would you say to those who want to keep statues like that up if they are to look at people as an objective human?
I think you're exactly right. Many of them were put up near the end of the 19th century, and what they were trying to do was create this lost cause narrative that the Civil War was just about states' rights and it mm-hmm. was heroic people. And there's some truth to that, but it's not the whole truth. And if I'm an African American in a southern town and I go to the courthouse to get justice and I have to walk by a statue of a Confederate soldier, mm-hmm. then I'm going to get a mixed message.
Yeah, I have to be honest with you, and I'm saying this with a lot of respect to both you and the service you've given the country, but I'm uncomfortable with even considering the idea that Robert E. Lee, somebody who fought our country for white supremacy and slavery should have any place in any of our prestigious institutions.
Well, that's the thing we're all wrestling with. There's a fort named after Robert E. Lee. And of course, for many years, he was the icon. And we sort of ignored the fact that he betrayed his oath. So I'm of a generation and a background where I can't let go of many of the things about him that I admired. Mm. But nor can I forget the fact that here's a person who did something that today he'd be branded a complete traitor for. Mm-hmm. And like Benedict Arnold, his name would be
mud, yeah.
expunged from many records.
Well, let's talk then about leadership and the things that we believe our leaders to be and want our leaders to be and the things that they are. You profiled a huge range of folks here. This is not people who were former enemies of the U.S. Army in Iraq and places. And also, I saw Harriet Tubman and Martin Luther King Jr. What are some of the universal qualities of a leader that you found in this research?
There are almost no universal qualities.
Good to know. Yes.
That's right. Because we say that they are brave or, you know, whatever. They're not.
So why do we do that as humans? Why do we start to ascribe all these different leaders who don't share similar qualities and give them these types of qualities?
Because we simplify it. We've considered leadership through the lens of biography. And that's why for this book, we went back to Plutarch to study his Parallel Lives of the Greeks and Romans. And what we find is we put a spotlight on the leader and we develop these mythologies of the way we think about leaders. We have this idea, formulaic mythology, that if a leader has certain traits or behaviors, that they will be effective. But yet, like Robert E. Lee, we find many who have all of them and fail, and others who seem to have very few and are very successful. We also tend to think that the leader's the reason an organization succeeds or fails. But when you really look at it, there's this wide variety of factors to include all of the other participants, we call them followers, have on it. And then finally, this idea that we only follow leaders that produce good results, like CEOs produce money or victories on the battlefield. In reality, we often follow serial failures. And because they meet an emotional need we have, it's much more emotional than it is rational. And so the leaders that we admire, elect, select, and follow, in many cases, are not the people that would do us the best good.
I'm speaking with retired General Stanley McChrystal. He's a retired Army general, co-founder of the McChrystal Group, and author of Leaders, Myth, and Reality. We want to hear from you. What do you think makes a good leader? What do you think about what the general is saying? 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. Or you can tweet us. We're at KQED Forum. I want to talk a little bit about Harriet Tubman. She's one of my heroes personally, and she has an amazing story that you outline in the book. Tell me why you got interested in her, and then tell me what surprised you when you started looking at this research.
We looked at a series of genres. We had founders, Walt Disney and Coco Chanel. We had reformers, Martin Luther and Martin Luther King.
The Coco Chanel, I'm just going to sidetrack just for one second. That was really interesting because you have somebody who's kind of like the top of high fashion who's really trying to make clothes that everyone can afford. That was amazing to read about
She's an amazing person who came up in a tough time. Harriet Tubman we put under heroes.
Okay.
And when we talked about heroes, we wanted people who had, in our minds, had become heroic figures. Mm-hmm. Harriet Tubman was the real deal. She's a 5-foot-tall African-American slave who escapes. Mm-hmm. Then she goes back into slave territory 13 times before the Civil War to lead out other slaves. If she had been recaptured anytime, she'd have been killed or put back into slavery, probably sold to the Deep South. She's not educated. Mm-hmm. She is not particularly charismatic.
Not book educated.
No, that's right. She's not particularly charismatic or a good speaker, but she's incredibly courageous and she's incredibly effective at what she does. And so those qualities make her deeply admired. They make her an icon for African Americans, for former slaves, for females, for all kinds
of Americans.
Exactly.
She should be an icon for Americans.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so for the rest of her life, but she's this incredibly humble person that even late in life has to apply to get a very small pension from the U.S. government for the work she'd done during the Civil War for the Army. It's those kinds of people that we have to celebrate, that we've got to study, we've got to understand, because there's real heroism there.
What about Martin Luther King Jr.? He, again, somebody I revere. I actually named my daughter after him. And one of the things that I have found in my own research of him in his life is he was a flawed individual, especially when it came to issues of family and things like that. What did you find in your research?
Well, I had grown up as a great admirer of Martin Luther King. My mother's side of the family is from the South, and she was very liberal and focused on the civil rights movement. So I was of the age when what he was doing was known to me. I remember the 1963 speech. The thing that jumps out about Dr. King is it's not the 1963 speech when he stands on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial and says these iconic words. It's the fact that starting in December 1955, as a 26-year-old new arrival to the city of Montgomery, he leads a 382-day Montgomery bus boycott.
Mm-hmm.
He then goes on for 12 more years leading the civil rights movement. He's never elected. He's never appointed. He's never positionally. And yet the civil rights movement is not this monolithic thing. It's big personalities with big disagreements, different groups. He masterfully manages and leads this against staunch opposition. So the fact that his cause was great almost causes us not to look hard enough at what an incredibly effective leader he was.
What about with regards, though, to his family? I mean, I'm wondering about this. You're absolutely right. Martin Luther King Jr. Was 26 years old. Of course, his dad was a
pastor,
and a very Atlanta at that time was the Black Mecca as it is now. But he had displaced other folks like Abernathy and C.K. Steele in Tallahassee, and these folks, these basically longtooths who had been there. For you know, years and years and years, here comes this young upstart. What was it about him that he was so good at that, but again, he wasn't able to kind of keep things working well at home? His wife is a saint for the stuff she had to deal with.
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, he had flaws, but we could go to almost any of these leaders and we could find something about him that was human and it was flawed. So I don't spend a lot of time worrying about that. What he did with the movement was he was incredibly adaptable. Mm-hmm. He wasn't inflexible. So at one moment, he would make the decision at the Selma Bridge to cut a deal with the police, to turn around on the first day, even though he was getting great criticism. The next day, he would make a decision to be put into jail and to push his cause. So what he did was he constantly adapted to the conditions, the political conditions, the tactical conditions.
He's shrewd.
Yeah.
Shrewd on-the-ground tactician.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so the fact that he had this guidepost of these strong beliefs, the idea that nonviolence was key and what the outcome was going to be, but then he navigated it deftly. And a lot of people just wouldn't have been able to do that.
Yeah, the other thing, too, that I think is really interesting is with King is he never mistook nonviolence for inaction or passive resistance. So that was very interesting to me. We're going to go down to some of our calls with the general. First up is Bob in San Francisco. Bob, what would you like to say to the general?
I find it very interesting to think about how historians, professional historians, academic historians, assess and reassess figures from the past. Robert E. Lee comes to mind. You know, there have been historians 75 years ago, 100 years ago, who put him up on pedestals, Douglas Southall Freeman and various others. In the last 20 years, you had historians like Michael Thelman come along and say, Michael Thelman, with his book in 2000 titled The Making of Robert E. Lee, it's a radical reassessment of the man. He describes Lee as fundamentally a white supremacist in the 1860s, after the Civil War. The role, my point being, the role of professional historians, and if we pay attention to what historians are saying, I think we can get some seriously good guidance.
Thank you very much for that comment, Bob. You know, General, it sounds in many ways Bob is saying that our heroes are representative of us and where we're at as a society.
Well, that's exactly right. And we need to be careful that we don't contextualize something from the 19th century and the 21st century unfairly. But we need to be open-eyed about it. And so I think Bob's exactly right. The 360-degree view is going to be much better than looking up and admiring only.
Let's hear more calls now. 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. We're going to go to our next caller, Jim in Santa Rosa. Jim, just very briefly, what would you want to say?
Hi, I wanted to comment on the statues, pro and con. A while ago, ISIS was tearing down art, and the world was appalled that they were tearing down historical artwork of former gods and idols and whatnot. And I'm concerned. I'm not pro or against whatever they stood for, but I think if we start tearing down all art statues, which are forms of art, we lose touch with the past. And I'm not an advocate of robbery Lee per se. I'm just a cautionary that we start tearing down artwork. Where do we end?
What do we say to the African American or the Robert E. Lee had a big hand in the Mexican American War? What do we say to the Mexican American who has to walk by that statue in order to seek justice in their tax funded structure? What would you say to them who don't share in that history?
I would say put them in a park somewhere, not necessarily at the front gate of a courthouse.
I'm assuming you're talking about the statues, not the people. Okay, just checking, just making sure. All right.
Yeah.
Okay. So don't tear them down is what you're saying. That's a very similar view we hear with other people. Why do these symbols matter to us so much? What did you learn about this in researching your book, Leaders?
Well, we use symbols for lots of things. One, we use them to give us inspiration for the future and to reflect what we think is important, just like the kind of Confederate general statues in the late 19th century. So I think they're very important for us, but I'm very sympathetic with the idea we either need to put them in the right context where they are, or we need to put some kind of narrative in front of them that says this represents also the time when it was built. You know, when the statue was erected, this is what people were doing, because I think it's unfair to leave them as the only correct depiction of the Civil War, which I don't think they were.
We're talking with General Stanley McChrystal. I want to talk a little bit about Walt Disney. That was another character you picked, another leader. Yeah. Tell us about how he saw himself and how he really was, because there seems to be a big gap in that.
Well, he was a gifted animator, and in the early years of his career, they invented Mickey Mouse.
Incredibly creative.
Yeah, they revolutionized animated films. And he created the first full-length animated film, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. It was a huge gamble because he had to mortgage his home, the business, even the intellectual property of Mickey Mouse to make it. But after 3 years in 1937, when it came out, it was hugely successful. Then the company grew, of course, as companies do. They built a new headquarters. They became more bureaucratic and organized, we might say. And he wasn't well suited for that. And by 1941, the same animators who had done such amazing work shoulder to shoulder with him in the previous decade and a half did this bitter strike against him. And he accused some of them of being communists and being disloyal and whatnot. And part of me, interestingly enough, part of me sort of sympathized with him. You know, you start a company. I've started a company. You build it up through the tough years. And then suddenly a bunch of workers say, well, we're not treated well. So I get the...
It sounds almost like any startup in San Francisco.
That's right. I get that. But he never was able to shift his leadership style to adapt to the new reality. And his brother Roy, in fact, ran the business in the decades after that.
And Walt served as kind of the creative force behind
exactly,
a lot of
Disneyland and whatnot.
We're going to go now to Jay, who says has some thoughts about this. Jay, you're calling us from Chicago, actually. Tell us what you wanted to say to the general.
Good morning. I wanted to ask about kind of this division between leaders and followers and heroes and people who are not heroes, and say, wouldn't it be better if we celebrated an action or behavior that gets us out of this problem of saying, well, Robert E. Lee is good or bad, you know, a binary decision, or Thomas Jefferson is good or bad, or Walt Disney. Humans are imperfect and complicated and emotional or rational, but we're each capable of very heroic actions or behaviors, and that's what we could focus on. And then we don't have this on-off. I'd be interested in your thoughts on that.
You know, thank you so much for Jay. You know, actually, to kind of veer for a second before you answer, there's a new theology that's been emerging the past 20, 25 years, post-Christian, which says don't forget about the idea of Jesus as the savior, and I'm not saying I'm poor for or against it, mind before we get calls, but look more at his actions and try to emulate those. Why don't we, in a general sense, not in a particular sense, why don't we do that?
Well, because we like to simplify. It's very simple to make a leader a great leader and then assume from birth until death that everything they do is great, or if they're bad, everything they do is wrong. I think Jay nailed it. Mm-hmm. Leadership is contextual. It's not only contextual. Look at someone like Winston Churchill. Mm-hmm. He had a moment in the spring and summer of 1940 when he was the soaring figure in the world and had this incredible effect on World War II. But before that, in the First World War and the decades, he'd been not
dour.
So. That's right.
Dour, and nobody liked him.
And he wasn't very successful after the war.
Right.
So the reality is it's contextual. But the other point that Jay touched on, it's also this interaction between followers. I actually don't like the term follower.
Okay.
I think it's almost partner or participant.
Okay.
Because most things that happen are the relationship between someone who's put on the docket as the leader, but in reality they're part of this reaction between other people that creates this outcome.
And I want to make it clear, based on my comments, I was not endorsing or not endorsing this doctrine. I want to make that very clear. A few questions now from a West Point dad. Would you share my view that a national mandatory service program, military or non-military, would help unify our divided country? We wanted to talk with you about that anyways, General McChrystal. And if so, he asks, how can we motivate our political leaders to make such a program a priority?
I could not agree more. In fact,
Did you write this, by the way?
I should have. For the last 6.5 years, I've been the chairperson for the Service Year Alliance to advocate for a year of paid national service for every young American. Mm-hmm. Those who want to go in the military, that's fine, but that's a small subset in healthcare, education. And the purpose is they would do good work, but the more important part is they would come away as alumni of an experience for something greater than themselves, mm-hmm. and also do it with people not from their zip code.
Mm-hmm.
And who do you not like? You don't like people you don't know.
Right.
Force them together. I think it would be the essential thing we could do to change America long term, increase a new vision of citizenship. We've been trying for 6.5 years to push political leaders to embrace this. John McCain was our strongest advocate.
Mm-hmm.
We have some other advocates, but we need a presidential candidate who will stand up and say, this is something I will push for. We need other candidates to do it. And I would ask the West Point father and everyone to pressure our political leaders to make this kind of program something really important for the future of the nation.
You know, what's interesting to me is yesterday I was down at the U.S. border observing Marines who are part of Operation Secure Line.
Absolutely.
They're doing the thing with. And, you know, in my business, in the news business, we have to, because of the nature of the business. We focus on division. We focus on things that divide us. And we also tend to be more, I want to say, individual. We're more individuals oftentimes in our career. We have a great organization here at KQED, but we are individuals. I was actually kind of jealous of the Marines because I saw them, and I'm just talking on a human level, they clearly had such strong feelings for each other. They were bored out of their minds when I saw them. They were finding ways to like keep themselves occupied. They clearly enjoyed the company of each other. And I thought it's so strange that, you know, that's the kind of thing we used to see maybe 15 years ago in the U.S., that glue that holds a society together.
We all want to be part of something. And why can't we all be Americans? Mm-hmm. Why do we have to view rich, poor, liberal, conservative, and segment ourselves that way? And I don't want to sound like I'm Pollyanna's younger brother.
Mm-hmm.
But I do believe the things that the experiences are what tie us. It's not civics lessons. It's an experience of working with people different. Because then you stop judging by the breed and start judging by the individual.
And I don't want to make it sound either that I'm, again, endorsing Mel. I want to be really careful with my observations. Can you give us any suggestions about how to put, you asked the participants, as you put it, to put pressure on politicians. What would you suggest they do?
Yeah, I think the first thing is to constantly ask questions. What we tried with the last election cycle was to put it into debates, mm-hmm. try to push that in, but it got pushed aside to other things. It's a very bipartisan issue. So in one sense, it would be good for a political candidate. On the other hand, in a very polarized world, they tend to go to the extremes. So what I would do is pressure, but also young people. We do a lot of polling on this. young people are very supportive of it. Mm-hmm. It's not that we'd have to force them into service. In fact, there's tremendous, much more demand from young people for the experience than there are opportunities to do it. Think City Year AmeriCorps and all these things. What we've got to do, really my generation and yours, John, we've got to step up, pressure politicians, and be willing to put some resources against it. Not all government money. There's got to be private and other money. But we got to be able to put our money where our mouth is.
You know, General, we're coming to the close of our time, and I did tell you that I wanted to veer off topic just for a moment, a very somber topic. I was in Thousand Oaks last week, and we saw a former Marine who served in Afghanistan, which, of course, you were the Allied commander there. He went into the Borderline Bar and Grill. He killed 11 people, and then also an officer, 12 in total. This officer, also a former serviceman. One of the things that's been claimed is that PTSD somehow drove him to do this. And you've dealt a lot with PTSD in the ranks. What would you say to folks who somehow try to link his military experience with the actions that he did?
Yeah, I would never judge on any single event because I don't know enough.
Yes, of course.
And PTSD is real. You go through traumatic things. But the reality is, I think what happens to more veterans is you have this incredible team experience. You're part of something. You can self-identify as a Marine or a soldier or a sailor. Yeah. And you have a group, a family.
You're part of that greater organ that we were just talking about a moment ago.
And we find this with wounded soldiers. As soon as they leave the battlefield, they're separated from their squad and their platoon. And it's very traumatic, more even than in many cases physical. So what I would say is many veterans come back, and what they've lost is that sense of belonging, that sense of identity, that sense of connection. Mm-hmm. And our society today doesn't really replicate that in other places. If you go back home to a loving family, PTSD tends to be less common. It still happens, but less common. So I really think that, you know, neighborhoods, towns send young Americans into the military. Then we need to receive them back. There needs to be a safety net of a community that grabs them as they return.
Is just very briefly, we have about 30 seconds. Yeah. Is in your sense, the armed forces doing enough to help facilitate that as well? I mean, we are always hearing about these problems at the VA and such.
No, they're not, but they never will. The armed forces are focused forward on possible war. And so when people leave the services, as well-intentioned as they are, they're never going to be able to focus as much on former military.
So it really is up to the community.
It is.
Yeah. Well, we've been talking. It was a great half hour. Thank you so much, General. General Stanley McChrystal. His new book, Leaders, Myth and Reality, is out. You can buy that if you so wish. General McChrystal, thank you so much.
John, thank you.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, who believe that all people deserve access to education and culture to enrich a lifetime of exploration and learning.